Radio Mom, I did Radio notice, DJs or something.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. See, I'm interrupting you now because you gave me a compliment and I feel uncomfortable, so I was interrupting you. Stop saying nice things. I can't handle it. I forgot to tell you that we got a puppy.
Oh.
We got a schnoodle.
What kind of dog is it?
I told you, a schnoodle. Oh, yeah. A schnoodle is a...
poodle with...
A schnauzer.
A schnauzer. Schnauzer.
Schnauzer. Bitte ein Schnauzer.
Genau.
Welcome to the CTO podcast. A show dedicated to all the brave humans showing up in technology leadership roles around the globe. Every week, we'll help you keep track of the stories you missed, the trends that might pass you by, and talk to people that shape how we should show up as chief technology officers. I am your host, Etienne De Bruin, founder of 7CTOs, and joining me as always is the creator of Amazing CTO Newsletter, Stefan Schmidt. Let's go.
The first thing I want to talk about is the easiest thing, which is a tweet from Andreas, who's, I think, from Sweden. And he's developing since some years an operating system, which is called Serenity OS. And as part of this operating system, he is developing a web browser. And he tweeted that he got a $100,000 sponsorship to develop that web browser, which is called Ladybird. And what I found amazing at the tweet is I find the Ladybird concept in general amazing because it's one person essentially building a web browser. And if I compare this to Mozilla, to Firefox, which is something I use since some decades, they spent $6 billion to build a browser. You know, they got $6 billion from Google to build Firefox in its current state, which I think is not the best. And then there is someone who wants to build a first-class browser, kind of small team perhaps, but kind of on his own. And that's what that is amazing.
That is the promise of just the fantasy I have of just a little project that I have going. I love it. My own... You know, no profit motive, no like business, no customer acquisition strategy plan, but just to build something because I love it. And then first prize is to have people then drawn to the project because they love what you're doing.
Yes. I had a discussion this week with one of my coaches, and we were discussing OKRs, which is one of the topics I discuss all the time, OKRs. And my point is that objectives should be transformative. They should be transforming your customers or transforming your company, transforming your product. It should not be more of the same. And then the coach said, how can I be transformative in one quarter? And I think this reflects belief that you need a lot of people and you need to spend a lot of money and a lot of time to do something that transforms a community or the world or something. And then on the other hand, there is someone who's building a browser on his own. So I think you can be transformative if you just, it happens in your head, you know, it starts in your head. If you think I can't be transformative because I don't have 10,000 engineers, you know, then that's what sucks.
I think that is so powerful because I think that thing in your head is the paralysis that happens when you start having team members as well. Oh, I can't do this because I first need to have this person involved or I need to run it by that person. And I can feel in myself when I am in those two modes. You know, I have a few teams in different companies and I can feel when I am in build transformation mode or when I am in, you know, lagging decision paralysis mode. And I'm like, okay, well, the team has, someone has to decide to do this. And then that never gets done.
Yeah.
I want to just read on Andreas's announcement of Ladybird. The Ladybird browser came to life on July 4th, 2019, when he recorded a video of himself making a simple Qt GUI for the LibWeb browser engine. And I really love that, because I feel like as a CTO type, as an entrepreneur type, I have sort of lost my just paint a painting for painting's sake, you know, just enjoy, just make something that you enjoy. There's no capitalistic profit motive behind it. Not everything has to be a business. So that yes. transformation mindset that I'm seeing in here to me is beautiful. My kids and I went to the Picasso Museum in Paris last year. And if you observe Picasso's paintings, you know, as the final product, I mean, it's a cacophony, right? Sometimes the paintings are misfigured people. And I know Picasso had a very strange relationship with the female body. And so there's a lot of disfiguration. But if you go to the museum, you see, of course, hundreds of art pieces that never makes it out of the museum. No one ever sees it because it's just not famous. But what I found fascinating about Picasso was he said in one of the little interviews we saw with him in the museum, he was explaining that when he was done with a painting, he actually felt sad. Because he felt like the process of creation around that piece had come to an end.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, what an unbelievable principle to have in life, where it's like I am enjoying writing this code, or I'm creating this repo, I am expressing who I am, and that's the journey. It's not, oh, I have to get this up into production as quickly as possible because I want to have other people. I mean, that could be fine as well. But I just found like that was a very interesting feeling. And I get that feeling from this tweet as well. Just, wow, man, I was here doing my thing and then I attracted some interest. But I feel like he would have been fine if that didn't happen either. You know, he's just enjoying his own journey.
Yeah. I think part of this is also, I totally agree, but part of this is also that as an industry and as developers, we kind of lost the creator mindset. We're very good at very good implementers, totally focused on implementing things, implementing tickets, but we lost kind of the creator mindset and the creator vibe and the wonder of being a creator. When I was a kid, one of my heroes was David Braben, who I think developed the game Elite, which was a very great game, great video game. And I think he did it on his own or two people. And I think this is creation. You know, this is ties in with what Picasso did, I think. Mm. And today we're too much of implementers. So
I love that the juxtaposition of implementer and creator. And I agree with you. I think the stresses of bootstrapping or fulfilling some investor's next wish puts us in a constant implementer mode.
So the next point would be Reddit CEO Steve Huffman praises Elon Musk cost-cutting methods amid widespread protest. And if you go into the article, the core idea here is that Elon Musk cut the developer and the tech force at Twitter by 70% or something, and which is a big gamble because Twitter could just have folded, and it proved that you need thousands of engineers, which ties into the first tweet. You need thousands of engineers to build something. And back then I said, when this was announced, I said, it will be interesting if Twitter survives as a technology product and still works, right? Because this might prove that you can have much less staff to do things or create things. And now we have a second person says, okay, Reddit could also be run by much less people. And this could, I don't know who's third, but that might kick off a wave into a different understanding on how we build tech giants.
Yes, I think one of the things we started hearing on other podcasts when Elon did this was how this was going to change the VC industry, because all of a sudden they're all going to say, well, hang on, if there's all this fat around development resources, why am I giving you a $20 million check? You know, like because the conventional wisdom is, you know, especially in sort of the seed rounds or Series A, is product engineering, you know, mature the products, and that equals hiring a lot of people. And what I find interesting about this, Stefan, is I wonder if there is this difference between the technical CEO and the non-technical CEO's understanding of what code does, what system architectures should be producing. And I don't know, I'd like to hear what you think, but I don't endorse what Musk did. What I'm saying is he did what he did. But I wonder if that came from a, clearly it had to come from cost, cutting costs because of his purchase.
Yeah.
You know, chasing profitability as quickly as possible, even while hemorrhaging the old business model. I understand that. But I do wonder if you consider his involvement in the Tesla production lines, you know, his understanding of rocket engines, his understanding or learning about system architectures around Twitter. I wonder if that hands-on technical CEO just has an ability to identify, like, listen, we have 500 people when really we only need 50. Is it because they understand the output where the non-technical CEO maybe doesn't have that understanding?
I think so. I think it really makes a difference that Elon Musk is a software engineer, isn't he? He came through PayPal. And I think he's a software engineer with a software engineering mindset. And some years ago, I read, when there's a discussion, who's the next CEO at Volkswagen. And some years ago, there was this discussion where the one person of the board, I think, said, perhaps one of our next CEOs will be a computer scientist, some like a former CTO. So it's no longer perhaps at Volkswagen that the CFO or the CMO becomes, or the COO becomes the next CEO, but it's from a technical point of view that you need someone to lead a car manufacturer. And I think that obviously that what he said was influenced by the fact that Musk has that background. And yeah. I think it makes a huge difference when you're running a tech company. The technology you build is make or break of your company, then you're a tech company. And I think that there's a difference if you have a techie at the helm or not.
Do you have any opinion about the current Reddit blackouts that are happening and the mods protesting the API metered usage that they want to introduce and all that?
I recently read an article where it said, why do companies need to grow and make money? I mean, no, because there are investors and people who invest money and want more money back. But on that scale, I think we will discuss this, I think, in a deeper way. Who owns the company? Is it the people who create the content, or is it the people who made the initial investment? So who's owning this? And legally, it's clear, but from a social point, it's not clear. I made a Hacker News comment, I think, on this, which says, if you don't pay for hosting, it's not your content. So if you pay for a forum or something, and then the company, the service providers provide that would not take it away from you. No, it would not interfere with your moderation. But obviously, if you don't pay, it's legally belonging to the company who owns the site. But I think it's challenging the notion. You might come with all the user-generated content, and it's also a little bit with AI, the discussion, like I have an AI engine that builds on other people's content. Who owns the output of the AI? There was this article from Japan, which says there is no copyright infringement ever. What the AI produced is owned by the person who created the AI. But I think it's a similar topic.
Yeah. I think one thing just from the news is that Christian Selig, who is the developer behind Apollo, one of the most popular Reddit apps, said that Reddit was going to charge him an estimated $20 million a year for access to its API.
Unbelievable. But from a company point of view, I mean, if you're a traditional thinker and perhaps Steve Huffman is in the same line as Elon Musk, if you're a traditional thinker, I think you can't let your business strategy be dictated by users in this way. And not that I agree totally, it's clear where he comes from. I mean, if you're no longer in control of your company, you're in a very difficult position from the traditional point of view.
Yes. And I wonder if Huffman, I think what was the big Twitter move where they also sort of made a bullying move towards all the Twitter app developers? I think maybe this is the response that they want, not from the mods, but maybe this is to dissuade third-party apps so that they can bring in their own apps and really own the vertical integration of users to their data versus, maybe this is sort of a sea change in the web revolution, where it used to be cool to sell access to the data through APIs, metered usage through APIs. And that was the business model, which is now being replaced by I got to own the vertical. I've got to own it all the way.
So the pessimist in me has two ideas. The first one is you will always find moderators that play by the rules. If the rules change, we'll always find people in that subreddit that want to be moderators and play by the rules. So it's like the moderators in this case, I think, are in a losing position. And the other idea the pessimist in me might say is, where is the future of Reddit with AI generated content, and not only content, but also AI chatbots that I can have meaningful discussions and disagreements with, like I can have with people on Reddit. So where in the long term, 5-year term, is the business model of Reddit perhaps? Now they see a gold mine of a treasure trove of accessing the data to let it get into an AI system. This is, I think, where they see some business model, but I can't see this as something long term. I think we'll go away. And then we talked last time about Stack Overflow, user-generated content on Stack Overflow versus ChatGPT, and that drop in traffic. Obviously, Reddit is creating some other kind of content, not just a question-answer content, but some other kind of content. They might be next in line.
CEO Steve Huffman said in a letter to employees that he expected this to pass, like all blow-ups on Reddit. He followed that up with an interview with NBC News where he suggested that the actions were taken by relatively few moderators who didn't have the support of their subreddits users. So yeah, this is a tussle with a SaaS company and their users, where the users have become king, So
takeaway for CTOs, it's a huge experiment that's currently running at Twitter that perhaps will run in Reddit. On how many engineers do I need to be a tech giant? Next up is called Imaginary Problems Are the Root of Bad Software, which goes a lot into software that solves the wrong problems. But what I particularly found interesting is the notion or the idea that what the article starts with, which is that developers work on imaginary problems because they are bored, which is something that I think is very true, that developers build a lot of stuff and solve a lot of problems because they want to be paid and they want to have fun. And having fun is working on challenges. And what I see, if I look into roadmaps, product roadmaps, there are very few challenges for most developers. And so they do other things to get their challenges. So that I thought was the most interesting point that's sometimes forgotten in that article. Developers want to have fun.
So the article says imaginary problems are often more fun to solve than real ones. Extremely intelligent people play competitive games, construct and solve math problems, and write books that aim to answer abstract questions about the human condition, all of them for free. A mediocre programmer, however, will probably charge you a fair amount to build a simple Android app. That's not because mediocre programmers are harder to find than geniuses, but because the former activities are all fun, while the latter can be quite boring. Amazing. I often run into situations where people ask me, hey, I'm going to hire someone. Can you help us with hiring? Even if it's an executive. And it's funny. I often tell people that the best developers in the world will work on your problem for free. There are people out there, for any given hard problem that any kind of tech company wants to solve, there's a cross-section of humans who will love solving that problem so much that they, money is not an, it's not a money, a question of money.
Yeah.
So I find that very interesting in this article, that sort of juxtaposition again, you know, more interesting challenges, more imaginary problems.
I find your take on the salary and the money particularly interesting because it's something I have discussions with a lot of CTOs because there is always the topic of salary raise, you know? And I think if people, it's also a symptom if people want to have a permanent salary raise or you feel there are too many salary raises, demand for too many salary raises. I think one of the symptoms is that developers are just bored, you know? They would work for less money. And I'm not advocating exploiting developers in any way. Everyone should get the money they deserve. And I tell developers to go to their boss, ask for more money. If they don't ask it, they don't get it often, too often. But people will not leave your company for more money if you have interesting challenges. But as I wrote in the newsletter, all you do is writing form to database code, you know, take a form, validate it, write it to a database. This is what you do. If this is a challenge, the challenge you have, then probably the developer wants to be compensated for his lack of fun and challenge by a higher salary.
I am working with a company right now, and they've got an incredibly awesome development team. And they are currently they're solving a hard problem, which is, and this might not sound fun, but they're actually having a lot of fun. They're taking a SaaS company's code base, and they are, you know, untangling all the technical debt and all the bad decisions that were made and really rewriting it into, they're crafting a new architecture. So they're decoupling the architecture and they're making some really great choices. And yeah, they have autonomy. They are reporting to me. And am making sure that they basically are guiding the process, doing what they want. But I have this nagging concern, which is once they've done that, and the app works beautifully and the architecture is firing on all cylinders. And now all they have to do is basically add this one feature or this little thing, or, you know, that the boredom is going to set in. And so it just begs the question, can scaling SaaS companies keep developers interested and help them have fun?
Not if you ignore the topic. Like, first step would be to acknowledge this and try to create an interesting environment with real, not fake, but real interesting challenges. Instead of trying to keep developers with more money.
I
never worked for Google, but there is this, perhaps it's a meme, but and it's not real, but Google just hires the best people to then write code in Java, you know, code that generates or manages ads in Java, but they hire the very best in the market because they have kind of the best brand. And then these people are, if this is true, I think these people are tremendously bored.
Yes.
And so this is probably where this 10% or 20% time comes in, because they are just so tremendously bored by their day-to-day job that do something, otherwise they're off.
Yes, and there was this article where there was this conspiracy that Google was hiring all these engineers just to get them off the market. Welcome.
If you have an endless amount of money, you know, an endless amount of money will distort a lot of things. I worked for a company who had a lot of money, and that distorted a lot of things. Yeah.
I think the moral of that story for me is it's really important to find out from your developers what does fun look like, and how do we combat the boredom. And in all my years, I've never been part of a management team where that topic was discussed. There was incentivizing and there was retention and there was learning budgets, but there's never like, hey, what's the fun factor? Are we on a 1 out of 10? Are we on a 2.5? Are we on 7? Are we on 9.5?
Surely not. 9.5, 2.5, best. In class.
This also, you know, this also reminds me of, have you ever been part of a total system outage, hard crash of an app or a service or something? Have you noticed how much fun people have getting those systems back up?
Yes. Yeah. I was sitting with some developers. I was hired once at a company who the website crashed all the time, losing millions. I was hired to fix everything. And then we spent quite some nights, all-nighters, in front of a Zoom call to get it working again. And some of my CTOs, it's a little bit different, but some of my CTOs, the people I meet, they have chaos going on. And they want to get rid of the chaos. And I talk to them. And after some time, I find out that the chaos is there because they like it.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
So on one hand, they want to go in and get it away because they get pressure from the CEO and from the company. But they create all these problems and all this chaos because they like it, because it's challenging. And otherwise, the job would be too boring. And then when we talk about this, they say, oh, yes, you might be right. I thrive.
Yes.
That's the reason I create chaos.
That is so fascinating. And I think our listeners should all think about chaos to fun ratio. Like, is that kind of one-to-one? Yeah, that's very interesting. It's very interesting. I will say the times that I was part of a war room situation or a all hands on deck, that was a lot of fun. A lot of adrenaline, a lot at stake. Checking in and like, okay, you're going to go do this and I'm going to load the database with that and you're going to go increase some instant, you know, and just that situation is a lot of fun. The only people who don't like it are the suits.
Next would be also an important topic that comes up quite often, which is estimation isn't for everyone. So there's a longer article about estimation and why for some people estimation is not the right thing. with some experiences described by a manager or a scrum master. And it's on the New York Times website. So I thought that is already kind of interesting, that this topic. It's in the open part, but nevertheless, it's still interesting that it's popping up there. And the idea, essentially, in the article is that estimation is overrated for a lot of people and kind of occult. And that's also something I see. I see something that people follow. They want to achieve things with estimation. They do, but they can't. They, by principle, can't achieve. So I don't know what's your opinion on estimation.
Yes, well, I'm sort of in the no estimates camp. You know, the whole no estimates war that flames up on Twitter, seasonal flaming. I'm a student of Woody Zool and mob programming. I find it interesting because when I am part of a scrum planning meeting, or when I am part of a sprint planning, I should say, and there's the scoring going on, the most value that I get from that scoring is to understand what the developer thinks the complexity is in solving that problem. I don't see it as a way to plan a project. I know the article talks about estimating is a means to plan projects, not a scorecard for evaluating employees. But I would go further and say it's not a way to plan projects unless in the moment when someone is estimating, that is a conversation. That is a, okay, I thought this was a small and you're saying it's an XL. I think that is the beginning of a conversation that can be had, not a conversation stopper, and it makes it up into the metrics and it bubbles up and it, you know, starts planning the epic and automatically pushes out the dates in some stupid ass Gantt chart. You know, but I think that that is a very insightful way for me to get a understanding of what the developer thinks. And for that purpose, I think estimation of the size and complexity of this project that we want to do, or this ticket we want to solve, I think that that is important. But I don't think that that is a, I don't think it's a sprint planning thing. I don't think it's a velocity planning thing.
I have another question. How do you deal then with demands by the outside to get estimation?
Yes, I, as CTO, I see this as a coaching moment. There are two scenarios, right? The one is we have a run rate, we're burning through our cash, we're spending X amount of that cash on developers, and we kind of want to land the MVP or the product alteration has to land within a burn rate. In other words, do we have to raise more money? I think it's important for the CTO to be able to participate in that conversation and have their business hat on. And if I see a CTO that is obstropolous or resistant or is causing friction in that scenario, I see it as a coachable moment for them to be like, listen, how can you be more of a catalytic mindset? It might be that you have to strip down your budget. You know, you might have to try and increase the run rate. You may have to be creative in how you can support the business through what your developers are saying. Yeah. So when there are the demands from the outside, I think it is crucial that the CTO is curious about where does that stress come from. And I think in many cases, there's an assumption that that stress is invalid or unfounded, and the CEO is just being, you know, vanity metrics, right? There's no reason for them to know how long it's going to take for this to get done. But I think a mature CTO is cognitive of the financials, and the profit margins and the operation cost.
Yeah.
And I think if you see it that way, I think estimations are important. I had to tell, for instance, one company that wanted to add a very important module to their whole product suite. And I had to tell that company it's going to take 6 to 12 months before they can add that module because of the way the system was architected and their development resources. Immediately, that time frame sparked a conversation. Oh, are we going to hire more developers? Oh, are we going to raise more money? Oh, can we do a feature freeze? Oh, can we go work on our existing customers and work on churn rates? But I felt like that was a way I was able to stimulate conversation around it, as opposed to it being a shameful thing where, oh my goodness, I can't give them what they want for 6 to 12 months and I am a horrible person. Maybe I should go code it myself. So I think in those circumstances, estimations are important. But I think in many cases, they're not important. And I think CTOs are reacting or have maybe built a mental model against all the times where the prediction from the model is this is not really necessary for anyone to know or understand.
I would agree partially. I would agree wholeheartedly about the CTO understanding the business and the finance and being an enabler and giving options and being part of the discussion instead of saying this does not make any sense or something. I would rather look into like something like OKRs and look into objectives and say we want to have not the communication between the company, I think, and the product. It depends on your business model, but in general, the communication between the company and product should not be around features, I think, but around objectives and impact. And then like, okay, what impact do we want to have in this quarter? And then we try to come up with stuff that creates this impact instead of how many things can we cramp into this quarter. There are some different business models, especially if you're kind of an SAP company, which is driven by the amount of features you have and the amount of ways you can integrate and stuff like that. But for a lot of companies, I would try to go into having an objective that is transformative and has impact instead of arguing about how many features you can cramp into a quarter, which essentially is the reason why people think want to have estimate. But then nevertheless, don't make product market fit or don't have impact. And for the estimation in general, I think it's a red flag. It should be a red flag that developers don't. I mean, there's some stuff developers don't want to do, like test, which I think is part of being a developer and part of the craftsmanship around developers. But estimation is something that developers would not come up with for themselves to solve a problem. So it doesn't solve a problem for themselves. You know, it's not something that they would do. Usually you do something as a professional or as someone, and you come up with things that you do to make your job easier or more effective or something. You create rituals or techniques in your job to make your job better. And estimation, I think, is something that developers would not come up with to make their job better. So that should be, I think, some kind of red flag. Still, I see your points and I agree with some of them, and there are valid reasons to have these discussions and have an estimation for the business side. Estimation is something that comes from the outside, inside the process, and not only for the interaction with other parts. It's not part of estimation. It's not only part of the API, but in Scrum, it's put into the core of the things people do. You know, and developers would not come up with this to make their life easier.
So when you say estimation comes from the outside, are you saying it's just more of a, like, developers wouldn't choose to estimate? It's more of a artificial or sometimes a legitimate business requirement coming from the outside.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think there are legitimate things from the outside, like laws and stuff that you can't ignore, or should you probably not ignore. But then there are things from the outside that especially don't, if they don't benefit you.
I think I hear what you're saying as a, we've somehow integrated estimation into a process, thinking that that is in service to the process when really it's not. If there is a time to have the estimation conversation so that you can understand the complexity of what is with what is going to be worked on. And I think that the subsequent decision there is, if you're telling me this is an XXL and I thought this was a medium, or the other developers thought this was a small, to me that is, okay, now we can make some decisions, break it down, which I think you should always obviously break it down, maybe get an extra developer onto this. Maybe you're not the right person. Maybe there's a more experienced person who can work on it. Maybe we should outsource this to a something. That to me is what I mean, and I think what we're both saying, that's an internal conversation of how hard do you think this is versus, oh, every morning when we do our this, we have to give weights, or we have to give Fibonacci, or we, it's like, why am I doing this? And I think that's to your point.
It's not helping me.
Yes. And you're right. I think it's a very interesting insight for me. And I love the way you put it, is it's, this isn't something that developers have chosen to do. This is from the outside, as you said.
It's a little bit like the CEO and, for example, GDPR or something. You know, I think a lot of CEOs don't like GDPR in the European Union. It's forced on them. They say it's not helping me. I don't know why I need to do this. And you know, and they don't like it. And it's the same with estimation. It's forced on the developers, and it's not helping them. And I mean, some might like it. I don't want to overgeneralize, but
yeah, there is always a fetish for anyone in the world.
I like to estimate. Oh, I love it. I really love it.
Two things for CTOs. I would rather not estimate if not needed. That would be one thing to do. And I think a lot of do this already. And the second thing is, from what you said, if my developers, and my always not as some kind of ownership, obviously, my developers, if they constantly disagree on the size of things or the complexity of things, and that I would, it would raise some concerns.
Yes.
I would say, why are you always disagreeing? Are the tickets too bad?
Yes.
So the requirements
yes.
are not clear? Or
yes.
don't you understand the code? Or why
yes.
is this
yes.
can happen sometimes, but if it happens all the time, I would be mystified and say, why is this happening?
Yeah.
You know,
and that is such a wonderful insight, you know, like I want that insight.
Got me.
Something I will do sometimes is if a CEO asks me how long would it take to do something, or when can we have it released, I sometimes answer them in dollars. I don't even answer them in dates.
Yes.
I just say this will be done after $250,000
yes.
spend, or this is, you know, we could do 500,000 spend, or we could do a 250 spend, or we could do a 3 million spend. And that immediately you're sort of hooked into what the way their brains work. In the back
yes.
of your mind, you
yes.
did a quick calculation because
yes.
you know what the developers cost, and you know what time, you know that there's, if you're doing 2 week sprints, you understand what a sprint costs. And that's where I want the CTO to live, is I want them to estimate in dollars.
I think this is so powerful what you said, this idea that think in their words and in their world. This is so, so, so important. And this is so powerful for CTOs, for success and happiness and communication and relationships. People might be bored. I'm not. Especially about that one, because it's about AI again. I mean, sometimes might be the day when we only talk about AI. I don't know when this is coming, but
or AI talks about us.
Oh yeah, there will be a podcast, an AI podcast talking about humans. You know,
the humans. This
oh,
is hilarious.
These pesky humans.
The humans,
you know,
just put on a recipe for strawberry parfait. This
yes.
is hilarious.
Have you seen
we find
this?
It interesting.
Yes. that will be. Today, there was a tweet by someone who was talking from a conference. A friend of mine was talking from on a conference and tweeting from the conference. And someone said, now automation, code generation automation is so good that all developers can spend all their time on conferences. So that, and the code writes itself. So developers only go to conferences and have fun, back at fun, you know. So the last topic is about AI, but I think it's interesting because it describes an interesting moment in AI. And the title was GPT-4 outperforms humans in pitch deck effectiveness among investors and business owners. So someone compared AI-generated pitch decks with human-generated wording, but with the human-generated pitch decks, and the GPT-4 pitch deck performed better. So this was kind of an iPhone moment again, where why would you do something? Before it was, okay, I save some work by doing this. And now it's, I need to do this because I might not get money otherwise. Like if all the other people use ChatGPT to generate, or the OpenAI or a free LLM model to generate pitch decks, I will be the one left out of investor money because the others are performing better.
The key takeaways are from this article, Clarify Capital, is overall investors and business owners say GPT-4 generated pitch decks are 2 times more convincing than those made by humans. Second key takeaway, overall investors and business owners were 3 times more likely to invest after reading a GPT-4 pitch deck than after reading a human one. 1 in 5 investors and business owners pitched by GPT-4 would invest $10,000 or more. Now, of course, naturally, my question was, well, what was the methodology for them to do this? And thankfully, they listed it. So the methodology was, in this study, we compared successful human-created pitch decks that had already secured funding against GPT-4-generated pitch decks. And we also asked 250 investors and 250 business owners to rate these human-created and AI-generated pitches, but participants were unaware that AI was involved.
This is the discrepancy between a human and an AI here again, that it just has a much deeper, broader and deeper knowledge of a domain, or a much deeper and broader knowledge of an investor. It's also listening probably to the, it's taking the investor point of view into consideration, a thing that a lot of humans don't do. So they don't consider their listeners. They just want to get their message out. So there are some factors that I think that just by design are in favor for an AI in this situation.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be hopefully a situation where the AI trains the human. I was just telling you we got a new puppy, and part of the puppy's 8 weeks old. And so here I am, interesting, right? Now I have a model that is untrained and the weights are still fairly neutral. The neural net is still fairly blank.
Yeah.
So we retained a trainer, a professional dog trainer, to help us with these first few months of the puppy. One of the things we have to do is we have to take the puppy from a crate, i.e. a cage, into the grass mat area where the dog is supposed to go and pee.
Yeah.
And so here I am thinking, I am training the dog to go from the crate to the pee mat, and only when the dog pees are we supposed to pick it up and give it a treat. So the dog has to learn the only way I'm getting out of this pee mat is if I pee and I get a treat. But here's the interesting thing, is the dog, I am being trained, because the dog sometimes will take 15, 20, 30 minutes on that pad. before it will pee and I can take it out. My initial neural network wait was, this is going to take 2 minutes. And now my model is being trained that standing there for 15 to 20 minutes is normal. And so, yeah, we have the untrained model in the act of training it, training this 50-year-old model and teaching me and re-weighting my nodes in my neural net. And this article sort of reminds me of that, where it's like we're going to hopefully have the humans trained what convincing pitch decks look like so that we can then in turn learn what a good pitch deck actually needs to consist of.
Yes. And I think it's even gets another notch, because I'm sure if you do this with a VC and a VC and there is an AI evaluating the pitch decks, you know, so you have an AI generating the pitch deck, send it over to a VC where an AI evaluates then the pitch deck. And then is the AI more likely to accept an AI or pitch deck or a human pitch deck?
That would be hilarious.
It would be hilarious if the AI prefers a human pitch deck.
That's what I'm saying. Pitch deck. I think it would be hilarious if the humans prefer the AI pitch decks and the AI prefers the humans.
I prefer the human pitch decks.
Maybe in the multiverse, there's a podcast happening right now between two friends, and they are laughing at an article that says the AI VCs prefer human pitch decks over. So it reminds me of this this conversation I heard recently with Sundar Pichai, which was talking about AI tools in Gmail. And obviously, I think one of the demos they did was how a Gmail AI plugin successfully negotiated with a travel agency or an airline to rebook the flights. And I think they got a refund. They managed to secure a refund or something. So I can see that, to me, sounds amazing. Hey, AI, go and just change all my flights because we want to leave 10 minutes later. Can you go and sort that out? You know, and the AI is like, yes, 10 minutes. You know, and it goes and does that. But in that same conversation, there was this interesting topic, which is what if you have Gmail, the same AI, create an email to your dad or to your daughter or to your friend? Like, hey, AI, go pretend to my friend who lives in Australia like you're interested in what they did for the weekend. And now this AI generates this message, and now and it sends it to a human, and now the human is reading these AI emails, and now that friend in Australia could say, well, screw this, AI, can you respond pretending like you, like,
yeah,
are we in for this great con? You know, and I'm sure you're seeing this. I'm starting to see AI generated messages being sent to me by people that I know and love. And it's very subtle. And there's no disclosure that this is what's happening and going on. And this article sort of is like teetering on, we're going to get into this handshaking, TCP handshaking,
Level 8, I think it's one level 7 TCP model, level TCP IP model, I forgot, but I think it might be 7 levels, and then TCP 7 and or HTTP 7 or something like, no, I don't know. And then on top of that is AI is the next, the ultimate network protocol layer.
And then imagine you have this handshaking going on, and then an out-of-band text from your friend is like, wow, did your mother die in a car crash yesterday? And you're like, no, my mother's fine. Meanwhile, the AIs have been emailing each other, trying to find excuses for why you didn't reach out to them or why you missed the party. You know, and then suddenly the human pops out and says, well, why, you know, trying to sanity check some data point, and you're like, and now all of a sudden you have this whole meta mess going on because the two AIs have been negotiating on behalf of each other.
Yes, same for your example before, like you, the Gmail, the booking is changed by 10 minutes and the only thing you see, okay, booking has been changed. And then you look into it and there has been 10,000 messages between these two guys negotiating, finding arguments for like, this should be happened 10 minutes. And the other says, no, it can't happen. And you need to pay money. I don't need to pay money for 10 minutes. And you know, there's been 10,000 messages between these AIs with a very elaborate, philosophical, deep arguments, you know? And like a multiverse had happened in this short amount of time between two AIs, you know, life of the question of life has been answered and everything in this conversation. And the only thing you see is, your flight has been scheduled, rescheduled, fine. And you say, meanwhile, that was easy. That was easy, you know.
Meanwhile, a whole new game has been created on Steam. It's been published.
Yes.
You know, there's a team in.
And the AI has invented a game. They have played a game. They analyzed it to every possible move and then came to the conclusion this is possible. And they came up, 10 minutes is fine.
10 minutes is
and
fine.
And you say, well, that was easy.
It's like, oh, great.
Don't know what happened. You did not know what happened.
You get a little notification. Oh, boom. Yeah. The AI rescheduled your flight with 10 minutes. And you're like, great. Meanwhile, there's a whole little village in the Amazon somewhere that's been ruined and destroyed because the AI decided they had to go make a turn in the forest.